Abracadabra, welcome to the Mouse Report. The screen says 1/24/2017, 12:02. So, since it must be Tuesday, this must be the Mouse Report. So, I was going to sample some Guns N' Barter like I used to always, but first there's a new Glenn Greenwald talking Chelsea Manning on Anderson Cooper's show.
And good evening. Thanks for joining us. Top of the hour, a breaking news reaction to President Obama's decision today to commute the sentence of Chelsea Manning, the former Army private doing 35 years at Leavenworth for leaking hundreds of thousands of government documents. Some called her a whistleblower, some called her a traitor. Whatever you call her, the decision to free her in May has touched off what's likely to be the final controversy of the Obama administration. Our justice correspondent Pamela Brown has the latest on all of it. She joins us now. How much of this was a surprise? I mean, has the White House been signaling they might do this for some time?
Well, the White House has stayed pretty tight-lipped when it comes to who would get the clemency grants. But today, Josh Earnest, the White House spokesman, in his press conference, signaled that it could be a possibility. He sort of set the stage before the official announcement was made when he drew the distinction between the Chelsea Manning case, in his view, and the Edward Snowden case, saying that Manning had pleaded guilty, that she had apologized, that she had already served some time.
It is necessary to note that Edward Snowden was overseeing the information flowing about the death squad funding of the Arab Sting. And so we're going to talk about the fallout of the Arab Sting, the Podesta emails that say, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, they're backing this assassination campaign, and of course, they're funding the Clinton Foundation, tune of $20 million, and all of that adds up to a racketeer-influenced corrupt organization, RICO suit, because prosecution for a conspiracy to murder of their counterparts is unlikely to be done by the perpetrators, although this is a new administration, so we got to see if he will live up to his threat, I think, in the words of Hillary, that fascist will have us all hanging from nooses. Well, we have lethal injection here in California, conspiracy to murder, Title 18, Section 11, 16, 11, 17 under federal law. Not that I am in favor of any of that insanity, because vegetarians won't kill animals for a reason, no matter how disgusting they are. Never mind.
It is only controversial but surprising to a lot of people when you look back at President and his tough stance on government leaks. In fact, his administration has prosecuted 9 or 10 such cases, and according to the New York Times, that's more than the past presidents combined. And of course, as we know, Chelsea Manning committed one of the biggest and most embarrassing leaks of classified information in U.S. history. And not only that, Anderson, but she really put WikiLeaks on the map and made it into essentially what it is today. And as we know, it also played a role as recently as the U.S. election, the administration says, Anderson.
And just a few days ago, the founder of WikiLeaks, Julian Assange, who's holed up in the Ecuadorian embassy in London, he indicated he would agree to U.S. extradition if Manning was granted clemency. Any indication that would actually happen?
Right. So his attorney is tonight actually said that he stands by what he says. And then another attorney says that he wants further clarification about his status with Department of Justice. It's interesting, though, because the U.S. has not formally made an extradition request for Julian Assange. In fact, he hasn't even been charged. The U.S. has just come out and said that he is part of an investigation, that he is the subject of an investigation. So it's yet to be seen how this will play out from here, Anderson.
All right, Pam, thanks very much. Journalist Glenn Greenwald advocated for Chelsea Manning's release, counts himself as a friend. He is co-founding editor of The Intercept and a contributor to her legal defense fund. We spoke tonight shortly before we went to air. Glenn, why does Chelsea Manning deserve to be released? I mean, she was found guilty, convicted by a military tribunal.
Well, let's remember she received the largest sentence in American history for somebody who released information to the public as opposed to, say, giving it to a foreign adversary or selling it to a foreign government. So she got a 35-year prison, which is wildly excessive in comparison to what other people have served who have done similar things. If you look at the top brass in the military, like David Petraeus, who leaked far more sensitive secrets than Chelsea Manning did, he didn't spend a day in prison. And I think most of all, was the conditions under which she was detained. The U.S. found that early on her detention was abusive and inhumane. She's had a lot of difficulty in a men's prison as a trans woman. She's tried to kill herself twice and was punished for it. So I think overall, when you combine the excessive sentence with the humanitarian considerations, President Obama thought it was just to commute her sentence.
You know, Paul Ryan has put out a statement calling this outrageous, saying that she gave up some of the most important secrets for the U.S. It's interesting, though, a lot of that rhetoric doesn't quite meet the facts. I mean, Bob Gates back in 2010 said that it was kind of overwrought, the language that was being used about the damage that was done. And even I think according to Reuters in 2011, an internal report. Surveys of the State Department found that the damage was not quite as bad and was nowhere near as bad as some had feared.
Well, there's literally not one case where anybody has been injured, let alone killed, as a result of this release. Not a single one. McClatchy investigated thoroughly in 2011 and said the Pentagon had wildly exaggerated the extent to which this had caused harm. But I think the most important point is the U.S. government classifies documents according to how sensitive they are. And the top level of secrecy is top secret, and there's gradations beneath that. The documents that Chelsea Manning released, not a single one was top secret. They were all very low-level classifications of either confidential or secret. So Paul Ryan really doesn't know what he's talking about.
I mean, diplomats did say that there was, in some cases, sort of a chilling effect on some allies' willingness to share information in the way they did before, but not necessarily the kind of the long-term damage that many had feared. Do you think this has any impact on Edward Snowden's case?
I think that the reason that President Obama acted was because Chelsea Manning had actually been convicted, expressed remorse, and then served 7 years in prison, as opposed to Edward Snowden, who to this day says he regrets that nothing that he did. He, in fact, if he regrets anything, it's that he didn't do it earlier. The American people should have learned about this earlier.
Of course, Glenn is not going to talk about the UBS death squad funding. Okay, he's going to talk about privacy in a similar fashion. The two MI5 whistleblowers talking about MI6 founding Al-Qaeda. And The Guardian basically says, so what if we're assassinating Libyans? So she had to say, well, when they get around to looking in your undies, how are you going to feel about that? So because the Americans supported Hillary's murdering the mother of the African Union, taking Libya that had been the poorest in the country, when they had their revolution and their independence, they became the wealthiest people in the country, standard of living equal to London. Because the misbegotten spawn of the slime buckets up the Thames supports this kind of thing, we are the children of the baby scalping. We are the 99% because the Hessian banksters paid us to our forefathers, founding mother rapers, to scalp the children, and we were reimbursed for the scalps of children here in California, state of California, reimbursed by the United States for that. So, never mind. So anyway, Glenn Greenwald is not going to talk about Scott Bennett being locked up with Bradley Birkenfeld. Remember the I should read because Holder, now Podesta emails, remember they were dodging all the scandal that had McCabe, the Virginia governor, giving $250,000 for the race of his wife or something like that through these Democratic machinery, all getting caught, and then pulling the, because of that, corruption, that's what shut down the FBI investigation. Anyway, you can look up those details and see how that all works out. But the whole system is dodging the controversy by having somebody who had Hillary at his wedding, you know, and his wealth is, you know, all traced to the Mafia Don's dad and stuff like that. So less of a scandal to investigate. Oh, yeah. So here I'm going to go and read UBS, 9/11, and Obama's bloody hands. Because, of course, we gringo, well, actually Yankees are more to the point. We funded Hitler and used that fascist project to shake down 240,000 tons or some ridiculous number like that of gold, and use it to crash the ruble, buy up the generals and the Soviet industry. And when RT is being blamed for dodging the investigation, well, it's the Russia that was already taken over, and now they're capitalists. So the idiots have hammer and sickle at the you know, the protest against the sick fart joke is blaming the hammer and sickle on the fourth Jim Crow coup. Of course, John Kerry was involved in the second Jim Crow coup, so and then the third Jim Crow coup was here in California, the theft from Bernie, and then the fourth Jim Crow coup was the theft from the third Jim Crow. Well, anyway, that's just a simple way to mouse to look at it, but I'm looking for my, oh, I gotta go back up here. I'm on Fart Book. I gotta look at more, and then you see the notes. You click on more, and there is my little public note on not 5300 Port Chicago Highway, murder mystery. That's another story. JFK assassination, the CIA insider view by Jim Wilcott. That's another story. Oh, UBS scandal, 9/11, and Obama's bloody hands. So remember, the only whistleblower, or the U.S. judge rejects leniency for UBS whistleblower, putting only the whistleblower in jail while all the major tax cheats who stole billions of taxpayer dollars escape without criminal penalties is outrageous and sends the wrong message, said John and Cohn, executive director of the National Whistleblower Center. After Phil Gramm left the Senate, he went to work for UBS. When UBS ran into heavy losses, he left with a $30 million package. The U.S. subprime and global financial crisis of 2008 was the result of policy implemented by the U.S. financial institutional caretakers of the World War II Black Eagle Gold Fund. Reagan Bush administration ousted Ferdinand Marcos, confiscated the Philippine holdings of Japanese pre-World War II treasury buried in the Philippines. Remember, stolen loot. Not being able to publicly acknowledge the illegal confiscation of multiple national treasuries, U.S. officials and their banker agents have released major portions of this fund, expanding the money supply by 3.5 to 7 trillion. Total amount of the treasure unearthed was in a magnitude estimated to be as much as 280,000 tons. Under international law, the gold should have been returned to the citizenry from which it had been confiscated. Remember the rape of Nanking? The U.S. cared as little about as we did the Yazidi genocide or the Armenian genocide before launching into those bogus wars. Of course, we knew that they knew that we knew, or we knew they knew we were shipping arms on the Lusitania. So the Balfour Declaration was the quid pro quo for getting us snookered into that atrocity, and of course the author was the one denying sanctuary to Jews during the pogroms in Eastern Europe. So it's all cannon fodder for the Holy Land Project, conceived of by Napoleon, the criminal funded by the Rothschilds, Scion Moses Bauer, who used that puppet to shake down the Prince of Hesse. You remember the Hessians here in the genocide on Turtle Island? Well, the loot from those millions of gallons of blood spilled was, you know, used to shake down the English, the slime buckets up the Thames, because you could use Judendeutsch to cross the lines you're funding both sides of. So I go into that little inn, Flowers for Algernon, Palma, Yahia, and Maria. Of course, Olaf Palma and Carl Friedrich Algernon were investigating the arming of both sides in the Iran-Iraq War, which goes to the Iraq gate, got the Kennedy killers out of trouble for Iran-Contra. Remember, we will not arm terrorists. Well, they were the guys that put them in there. Thatcher, Reagan, and Bush were in Tehran in 1978, and there were emails. But anyway, so these costume shithooks of medieval misogyny were put in place, kind of the strategy of 73, when the Arab oil embargo was the response to the West marching north through Lebanon. Well, then no longer would we have cheap Arab oil. And even the Saud king had to go along, although he was assassinated, and then the oil minister saved the nephew that shot him. But well, anyway, so Glenn Greenwald is fully aware of those 19,000 bank accounts funding to throw acid in women's faces, the Salami state. It's called the Salafist Principality in 2012 DIA document. Okay, the redirection, the Negroponte Salvador option before that, but in 2017, Seymour Hersh spelled it all out with the redirection. Okay, that is where your Islamic State, your chosen enemy is. And I think on the 21st or the 2nd, they bombed like 100 of the leaders of Daesh, and that's the name of your Al-Qaeda. It means CIA database. It's the Arabs sent to Afghanistan. And it's part of that strategy of throwing acid in women's faces so we could go back to getting cheap Arab oil, because they're the poison pill. They're the Islamic Brotherhood. I couldn't stop Reagan from giving my money to in 1985. I got a letter from Norman Shumway, my congressman, saying even the president can't stop giving your money to force people into the Islamic Brotherhood, the state religion. Muhammad Mamun Taha was executed one of those coming Fridays for refusing to give up Christianity. Oh, yes, any of that, blah, 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 blah. Marcos and the confiscated Philippine holdings, Japanese pre-war to return in the Philippines, expanding the money supply by up to $7 trillion. Total amount treasure on Earth was in magnitude estimated 280,000 tons. Bush and Greenspan funded a covert operation in 1991 in the range of $240 billion. One of those insiders was the wife of a minor covert fund manager, CIA operative Russard Herman of the Durham Trust, and the other was the long-term program manager of the covert fund, General Earl Cox, C-O-C-K-E. They used the gold to fund a covert economic war that caused the collapse of the Soviet Union. So that's where the Yeltsin crowd comes in to power. Remember, they bombed the parliament, the Duma, and all. They were Western puppets, and that is who the FSB, Federal Security Bureau, the formerly called KGB, or you could call them both, when they were blowing up apartments using hexogen, it's the same propellant used in these sarin attacks. Now, okay, so you see these guys giving 13 shots to children. Well, it only takes a single shot to kick on your sympathetic nervous system. Remember, there's parasympathetic, vegetative, and sympathetic, your fight, flight. Well, the sarin and other organophosphates pesticides slow down your heart rate and breathing to death. That's what nerve agents do. And the antidote is a simple shot to kick on your sympathetic nervous system. So you don't need 13 shots. Obviously, these are... And the fact that hexogen is being used, well, that's what the two sides are staging this turf for. We're blowing up apartments. Now, they taped over the paper so they wouldn't see this is a car from outside, to show the local number, and the guard at the apartment saw it, and they saw the explosives in the basement, and they defused it, and then they were sitting in the FSB in Yeltsin's spy department's basement until somebody tried to put it in their coffee because it was labeled as sugar, but it was hexogen. So this is the same thing they're using as propellant. These guys in the Salami business turning people into salami, and they call it Islamic State, but so remember Chechnya? Well, that's where Dzhokhar's come from, Tamerlane and Tamerlane and Dzhokhar Tsarnaev, right? Tsar as in Tsar, as in Caesar. Okay, but the Uncle Ruslan says, my nephews are bad. They did it. Well, he's married to the daughter of the CIH station chief in Ankara, whose daughter's middle name is Ankara. But Graham Fuller, okay. So then you have this tax day bombing in the CIA JFK, the CIA's target JFK RFK home state on tax day, and they have bomb sniffing dogs and the bombs go off. So it's obviously a staged event. The Boston EMS practiced for this several years before. They had the website, a mass casualty event is going to be planned, and it happened to be on tax day, you know, so there's that not so subtle message there. But we're framing Chechnya, and that during the time we were asking Putin to let us have our way in Syria, and we were saying, look at these bad Chechens because they married the state, and then they're going to be working for Halliburton, okay? Now, when we had our brains blown out 50-plus years ago, the vice president was saying, I'm going to have to sell my goddamn Halliburton stocks, you know, on the very day. Well, let me get out of here. Okay, now we're going to go to last week's show. I always did it better last week. Play a prize, and you didn't say word one about your fellow journalist who's murdered by the FSB, obviously, by the Kremlin. Now, when the Kremlin blew up Moscow, the fifth apartment building didn't blow up. That was in Ryazan, okay? It was Hexagen, the same that the KGB, or the FS, let's call it the Federal Security Bureau, and Pirates of the Potomac cooperate in waging over the, Caspian oil. So this goes back 1,000 years. Now, the first czar is piggybacking on Caesar, okay? Rome. Now, Europe couldn't count after Roman rule. It wasn't until we were invaded by Islamic Arabs. So how wonderful that we are going to go wage war on this, you know, Arabic script, basically. And Bush actually talked about W, the son of Hitler's banker, grandson of Hitler's banker, about abolishing Arabic script. My point in there was that we represent the infinite by dividing by zero. So how are you going to do that with Roman numerals? You cannot mathematically represent the infinite, and there's a psychological dimension to that, I believe. We divide by nothing. That's the rule of peace. The rules of war are divide and conquer, blame the victim, play dumb. When you're shooting at a king, it doesn't matter if you're caught. You want people to know, you know, if you're committing an act of terrorism, you want people to know who did it, or they won't know who to be afraid of. So those are the rules of war, but the rules of peace are simply divide by nothing. Okay. When we're undivided, we are infinite.
Of course, if you can't count, then you can't represent the infinite, so you can go out, murder, rape, and pillage, and propelled by your fear of death. But okay, she's human. She's not gonna...
He's like Daniel Ellsberg. Now, when he was talking at an event about Afghanistan war, I told him to not talk about the inside job, is to cover it up. Of course, it's all pretext on this defense stand down, according to plan, using drones to use staged deaths of Americans to unleash the military. But he said, I disagree, because he's a liberal. He has something to lose. And I think that's what's being talked about here in this week's Guns and Butter.
Was a young woman named Germaine. And Germaine was one quarter French and three quarters Vietnamese. She was connected with a whole group of French Corsicans.
Speaking of a whole group, so there I was with Daniel Ellsberg, Brian Wilson, and they're both in fundamental denial. In his book, he talks about Operation Northwoods and says, fortunately, it was never done. Well, 63.
Some of whom had been trafficking and opium in South Vietnam and Laos for many years. And Dan started a relationship with this young woman, Germaine, even though he knew that she was the girlfriend of a Corsican drug trafficker named Miguel Seguin. And this is in, I think, the summer of 1965. Scott was telling me the story, and he said, well, it almost blew up the entire underworld, this relationship. And this guy, Miguel Seguin, let it be known that he was going to kill Dan. And he said, the stories about how it actually unfolded are slightly different, but they're all basically the same thing. Miguel Seguin sent an assassin to kill Dan Ellsberg because he was romancing his girlfriend. And Scott and then Lou Conine, Conine, who had been in the CIA for 20 years at that point, 15, 20 years, actually had to go to the Corsican underworld and tell him to back off and not kill Dan, or else there would be a gang war in Saigon between the CIA and the Corsicans. Okay? So it's a fabulously interesting story, and I asked Dan Ellsberg about it, and he said, well, he had a slightly different version of it. He said that this guy Seguin actually came to the villa where he lived with Scott and put a gun to his head and said, stay away from my girlfriend, I'll kill you. And then I asked Dan Ellsberg, well, were the Corsicans dealing drugs? Was the CIA involved in that aspect of the underworld? And he flatly denied it. He said that his boss, Ed Lansdale, General Ed Lansdale, who he really admired and he considered a mentor, Lansdale had been in the Philippines in the early 1950s, and he had put down the communist insurrection there. And then in 54, he was sent to South Vietnam to do the same thing. And he's Lansdale, the guy that put ZM in power. Lansdale was there until 1958. And Conine, Lou Conine, was with Lansdale that whole time. Conine came back to South Vietnam around 61 or 62. Conine was the guy who was the liaison between the CIA and the generals that assassinated ZM in 1963. Conine was still there in 65 when Lansdale came back. So you had Lansdale, Conine, Scott, and Ellsberg all working together. There's a very famous photograph of Conine and Ellsberg in a boat together. But when it comes to the CIA and drugs, Dan says, no, there was no relationship, whereas Conine told Al McCoy, who wrote a very famous book called The Politics of Heroin in Southeast Asia, that in 1965, the CIA actually made a deal with the Corsicans that not to interfere in their drug running as long as the Corsicans served as informants.
Now, with Giuliani picked by the new Sig Fart Joke Select, there's the fact that he got his name mopping up the Sicilians. Like, he prosecuted the head of the Sicilian Mafia, blah, blah, blah. Oh, also John Gotti, who, like, chainsawed a neighbor in half or something. But the Sicilians are winding up dead as they're being swapped out for the Pakistanis. So this is the horrible 80s. We're moving the Contra war to South Asia, and that's where the Arab Afghans are. The Al-Qaeda is the CIA database, Arabic for database. And so as the CIA is moving its middlemen from Sicilian to Pakistanis, there's all these dead Sicilians winding up on the street, and Giuliani makes his name going after the top of that little network because, see, he's a team player in the Afghan opium war. And so you couldn't get a better continuation of the policy than having this this Islamophobic theme, which is 100% consistent, and Drone Bomber hasn't changed an iota, carrying on the first, second Jim Crow coup by waging, in fact, increasing the Afghan opium war, increasing troops by 30,000 or more. Anyway, so Giuliani is the guy who is swapping out or helping to ease the way for the Pakistani middlemen for the heroin that's killing our friends. All my friends died from Vietnam, car crashes, and smack. Goddamn the pusher man.
For the CIA. So I wrote this article that gets very elaborate, and it's called The Clash of the Icons. Do you believe, on the one hand, Dan Ellsberg, who worked intimately with all these CIA guys for many years, and saying that the CIA wasn't involved in drugs? Or do you believe Al McCoy, who spent many years researching the subject and shows beyond any doubt that the CIA was controlling the whole business? It documented the whole thing. Who are you going to believe? And the other thing that Scotton told me, which was kind of controversial, was that he had actually put Ellsberg up to release in the Pentagon Papers. And I asked Dan about that as well. And he said, no, it absolutely wasn't true. That Scotton, when I saw him, was, sort of laughed. And he said, we are the ones that put Ellsberg up to releasing the Pentagon Papers. And we, meaning Colby and him, I didn't ask anything more about it at the time, but I did ask Dan about it. He denied it again. And apparently he already had the Pentagon Papers in his possession when, in late 1970, when Scotton showed up at his house and saw the Pentagon Papers there. And it may have, there may have been some conversation about it at that point, but in an autobiography that he wrote recently, Scotton denies having put Ellsberg up to do it, although he did tell me that they did. So anyway, you come across these kind of things, and they're the kind of insights into what the CIA does in terms of corrupting foreign officials. Like, for example, Neil Sheehan was part of this group, the New York Times reporter. He was there. He knew Scott. He knew Ellsberg. Back in those days, Halberstam was there. They knew these guys intimately. They partied together. They knew everything that was going on at this very intimate level, and yet they didn't report on it. They didn't talk about this kind of aspect of how CIA officers in their private lives, the kinds of things that they were involved in, the way that they would integrate into the culture, the way they would work and maneuver through
these scandals that Glenn Greenwald isn't going to mention. He's not going to mention Eric Holder and Lanny Brewer worked for Covington and Burling. This is a law firm for the Union Bank of Switzerland. Now, remember those 19,000 bank accounts paying for the Yazidi genocide? Okay. Glenn Greenwald doesn't care because, I don't know, maybe because The Intercept is bye-bye billionaire and stuff. But securities from the $240 billion covert war were settled in the aftermath of September 11, 2001. This meant that $240 billion jumped from the off-balance sheets accounts to the balance sheets of their respective holding banks and had a major impact on the money supply. There was an ongoing and massive expansion in the money supply during the 7 years prior to 9/11/01, attributable to the officially denied sell-off of undeclared U.S. government gold stocks, according to Reginald Howe, H-O-W-E, in his 2000 lawsuit against Bank for International Settlements. Alan Greenspan, William J. McDonough, J.P. Morgan & Company, Chase, Manhattan, Citigroup Incorporated. Now, Citigroup is the one whose email to Podesta gave Drone Bomber his cabinet. Geithner, Summers, Holder. Okay, Goldman Sachs Group, Inc., Deutsche Bank AG, and Lawrence H. Summers, Secretary of the Treasury. The covert sell-off of U.S. gold started in 86. Kissinger and Bush, Ferdinand Marcos from office as president, confiscated his gold. Astute gold traders noticed gold appearing on the markets with no clear sourcing, and this observation resulted in the Howe lawsuit, an FBI investigation, FBI was unhinged with the attack on the World Trade Center. Now, of course, Lawrence Summers, the Prince of Darkness, Yanis Varoufakis talked about him, offering him a gate to the inside where you just got to not talk bad about the insiders, it seems. Glenn Greenwald is cutting that same thing because he's not talking about Obama and Hillary's prosecution for conspiracy to murder their political counterparts. In fact, if we want to step into a phone booth, we have to prosecute drone bomber Hillary for the conspiracy to murder their political counterparts, because that makes it natural, if not legal, for anyone to do the same to ours. And for nothing in the world would we want our people so targeted. Quoting myself in Getty versus Casey, Timothy Geithner joined Treasury in 88 in the International Affairs Division after spending 3 years with Kissinger Associates, where he earned his covert operations credentials. Remember, Kissinger was the one that said, the only thing that can keep this country together is an act of domestic terrorism. That was December of 2000. And it's pretty true. I was trying to recruit for John Brown's army to go re-up the Civil War abolition of slavery when they had roadblocks in the hoods because of, Mr. Bill's civil rights hit person, M.F. Berry, calling it laughable when it was indictable. But never mind. And she's heading the forum. Timothy Geithner joined Treasury, blah, 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 blah. Oh, yeah. Kissinger was the individual who wrote the letter to Ferdinand Marcos demanding to relinquish his gold to the U.S., while Geithner was at Kissinger Associates. That firm was involved in Brazilian Ambassador Sergio de Costa's BCCI scandal, the Banco Nacional de Lavoro, BNL scandal, and helping arm Saddam Hussein by getting bank credits for grain for Iraq, then swapping those credits and grains for arms. BNL would ultimately be taken over by HSBC in 2006. Oh, yeah, so Loretta Lynch is also involved in the cover-up of the...
not Kamala, right?
No.
Not Kamala. Kamala's okay.
Loretta Lynch. Yeah. I got nothing bashing Kamala today.
I love Kamala.
After joining Treasury, Geithner became Deputy Assistant Secretary for International Monetary and Financial Policy under Treasury Secretary Robert Rubin and Lawrence Summers. October 2003, he became President of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. Oh, yeah, so he was arrested briefly by the state for obstruction of justice for lying to Congress because the New York Fed was giving Goldman 100 cents in the dollar. AIG was giving Goldman 100 cents on the dollar for underwater crap. But then he said, Obama and I are working for Poppy Bush, son of Hitler's banker, and they dropped him like a hot potato because they didn't want to hear any of that. In October 2003, he became president of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, where he became vice chairman of the Federal Open Market Committee. There he would be accused of supporting a cover-up. Yep, by lying to Congress. Cover-up of Al-Qaeda money. Oh, that's another thing. Al-Qaeda money from United Arab Emirates, Pakistan, and Saudi Arabia for possible terrorist-related purposes prior to 9/11/01. Oh, and I'm quoting a lot from Collateral Damage Part 2, The Subprime Crisis and the Terrorist Attacks on September 11, 2001, by E.P. Heidner. That was December 25, 2008. And there's more on this. If you go to Greg Allen Getty and you go to more and you click on the notes, you can read that yourself.
That Greg guy really knows what he's talking about.
Well, he should, because the chicken hawks that my chicken hawk uncles that threw my daddy in to drown before he was rescued by the littlest Clifford.
How easy is driving on steep hills with Highlander's enhanced powertrain?
We're going for a Project Camelot, Scott Bennett, CIA.
Feels like any other road.
Swiss bank funds ISIS. So when Glenn Greenwald is talking, he's not mentioning what he knows. Because, Edward Snowden has released these things, and the press isn't talking about it because they support the assassination program. That's what America was founded on. Dun-dun-dun-dun. Let me hit pause until we get into the meat of this.
We're terminating you from the contract and the company. basically firing me.
Incredible. Okay.
And I said, and I knew right then and there, I had ruffled feathers beyond their liking, and it was directly because of the reports and the recommendations that I had been making that was looking into terrorist financing and these international banks and entities and charities and systems and processes. And my downfall with them, and also my strength, I was like a doctor probing a wound. I was trying to find out where we were going wrong, what we were doing right to fix it. And their mentality in Booz Allen Hamilton and the general contractors, and I say this with utmost respect, their mentality is really an old man mentality with castrated imaginations. They're tired, they're bureaucrats, they've served in the military for 20, 30 years. Now they're joining the defense contractor industry, and they're coming in just looking to shuffle paper around. And
rather than seeing it as an outright conspiracy, but there is another way to look at that, correct?
Well, there's the way to look at it in one light is that a lot of the people who are studying and searching for the terrorist financing accounts don't want them looked for and don't want them discovered. They don't
right.
want them known.
So we're talking about a cover-up.
We're talking about a cover-up, and I didn't really know about this until much, much, much later.
When you don't have to be very surprised when the California Specialized Training Institute has a book by Kitson, and the text reads, "Expansionist whites in a quest for power have stolen this land and incarcerated the inhabitants for the last couple of centuries. It's only by understanding that illegitimate violence has its roots in causes of social injustice that you can do your job. And your job isn't to eliminate violence. It's integral to the system. We need it as an excuse to purge these elements," you see. So that's why the strategy of tension requires what he's describing here. There's nothing surprising, only nauseating.
When all of this sort of came to me from Brad Birkenfeld, and it's a weird cosmic world we live in, and coincidences, things kind of fall together. I mean, I look at this as a man of faith, that this is a very spiritual sort of God-centered happening.
Well, it's possible there are people in the system maneuvering Scott Bennett's to be imprisoned with Bradley Birkenfeld. So the military are working under this. Like, they read the newspaper. They know about these 19,000 bank accounts funding the people that they're going to go over and have blowing themselves to smithereens. Now, how are you going to deal with a suicidal leader? You cannot scare a suicidal person. Well, you got to understand, we're stealing. We're going into their house. They're as suicidal as you would be if someone came into your house. And then, of course, just got to play dumb and drive the getaway car for the 10 million corpses in the Congo that Hillary represents, because Trump is so bad. In fact, he is evil's Trump card. He is the greater evil for her to be a foil against. And he played a greater evil, you know, all throughout the campaign. That was his role. And surprise, surprise, they selected the greater evil. Oh, boy. Oh, no.
Happenstance. How I had been down to Central Command as the man in charge of finding terrorist money sources, and then I was kicked off base, and basically later on I met accidentally the Swiss banker Brad Birkenfeld, who brought me all of the information that the military and the Senate refused to provide our team. And Brad and I sat down for 6 months and looked at all of this, and I said, "Brad, all of this should have come to me and someone in a military uniform. And you're telling me not one time did a military person ever debrief you with your 19,000 bank accounts, that a lot of which belong to Al-Qaeda financiers, terrorist financiers, Saudi Arabians, Qatar, Kuwaitis. No one in a military uniform ever came and conducted any sort of debriefing with you?" And Brad said, "No, not once, not ever did any military person ever speak with me. In fact, Kevin Downing and Kevin O'Connor at the Department of Justice, the prosecutors, had forbidden Brad from talking to anyone about this material." And I said, well, that's where the smoking gun is, because this material should have gotten to us. It specifically shouldn't have came to me, because that was my job at Booz Allen Hamilton in the military. My job was to basically empty your pockets. You were the golden goose I was looking for. Empty your pockets, and I could have in one night tracked down every terrorist finance bank account, and working in coordination with the Department of Treasury and others, we could have instantly shut down 19,000 accounts and dried up the money source. And the significance of this now is all of the money that perhaps we're seeing going to ISIS in Syria, in the new erupting Islamic State, all of this money could have been shut down in 2010, and we wouldn't have the problem, the issue that we have now. Now, getting back to your point, why was that not done? Well, there's a lot of forces, a lot of agencies, a lot of people that perhaps never wanted it done. They wanted to foment a instability in the Middle East for control. There's a myriad of explanations, but
well, okay,
sticking to the facts.
Yeah, and that's absolutely somewhere that I want to go in this conversation, and we can go down that road. But before we do that, I want to make sure that we get the Birkenfeld sort of piece put into this puzzle, and then also the Snowden piece and the Hastings piece, because it's kind of a trajectory. And so
yes.
You're saying it's a coincidence and how things came to a head, and you actually got thrown in jail, of all things,
yes.
For 2 years, if I'm correct?
Yeah.
And I just want to say here, though, that there are no coincidences in my world, and so I have to think that this is fortuitous and that you have some, we call them white hats, behind
yes.
the scenes that had seen that you had done a good job, seen that you were a good guy, and that you were being framed. And they made sure that when you went into prison, you got connected with the right guy. So can you tell that story?
Well, it's certainly the optimistic and, I pray, truthful underlining current of all of this. When I returned back to when I left Booz Allen Hamilton at U.S. Central Command, I returned to my Army unit, and I had been it explained that a lot of this was nonsense, and I had requested military counsel to address this matter and make another direction. When I returned back, Michael Hastings had done a story on General Stanley McChrystal, and he had also done some analysis of Mike Furlong, who was a colleague of mine that I worked with at the State Department, counterterrorism. Mike Furlong had, I won't go into a lot of the details of his operations, but had been very successful in generating counterterrorism operations and personnel, and I'd worked closely with him. And when I got back to my Army battalion, our brigade commander, General Burley, had come out and said at a meeting at our battalion, psychological operations is being changed to MISO, Military Information Support Operations, because of Mike Furlong. Anybody hear that name? No one raised their hands. I was the only one, and I went cold because I thought, I know Mike. Where is this coming from? And he went on to talk about Mike Furlong. And Mike Furlong had been targeted by CIA, and they came down on him like a load of bricks because he was so successful in some of his operations. And I had Colonel Burley had also said in a side to the Furlong issue, we are doing the don't ask, don't tell change in the military. Do you have feedback? And I had written a report in response to that saying, sir, with regards to the don't ask, don't tell, that could be used as a psychological warfare platform for recruiting and destabilizing countries within the Islamic radical cleric establishment. They can propagandize this. So we have to be very cautious in how we unfurl this. And the Obama administration and a lot of people in Congress had made a point to determine that they wanted to move forward with that change. And the significance of this is I wrote a report that's contained in the book in November. It took me a few months to put together, but in November I submitted a report, sent it up to John Boehner and Buck McKeon and all the people in Congress, as well as the Pentagon officials saying, if we change the don't ask, don't tell policy, here are the negative implications. Here are the radical terrorist Al-Qaeda responses that they will initiate. And it was very thorough. It was very technical material from think tanks, was synthesized. So it was a very scholarly report. And my background was in this at the Heritage Foundation, so I knew what I was talking about. And 1 month after submitting that report, which went, when a lot of the guys in the military, Colonel Joel Droban particularly, went absolutely bonkers and batshit crazy over. They were furious that I had submitted a report that went against the president's recommendation of changing Don't Ask, Don't Tell and allowing homosexuality in the military. And 1 month after submitting that report, I was indicted by the Department of Justice for a base housing application paperwork error. And it was they shifted that to look like a false statement. I basically filled out some forms for my base housing, which is a questionnaire. And they had charged me 1 month after this report, they charged me with making a false statement, 18100-1, things that were tied to Geithner and a lot of people in the Obama administration, and as well as the Republicans. And Brad had been making a lot of noise in the Union Bank of Switzerland hierarchy, professional hierarchy, about problems and issues. Well, he had been approached by some people who, make a long story short, had got him out, went to a bar, got him drunk, and got him stopped with a DUI, the same thing that they tried to pin on me. DUI charge, he was put in jail, and next thing he knows, the people that had approached him came into the jail cell in Switzerland, Geneva, flashed a CIA badge, and got him out. Approached him for information and tried to recruit him, and Brad, getting nervous and wary of it, goes over to the United States with his bad material information to release to as a whistleblower. Now, what's significant about that is Edward Snowden and his material revealed to Glenn Greenwald in 2013, his first interview, which you can look at, said his turning point was when he was a Geneva CIA analyst and he saw the Swiss banker Brad Birkenfeld being targeted for CIA recruitment in a phony DUI. So Snowden is up here and he sees Birkenfeld being targeted by the CIA. That's pretty significant. So you build the bridge between the two of them right there. Edward Snowden, Brad Birkenfeld. Brad then packs his bags, flees like a bat out of hell to get out of there, and comes over to the United States and goes to the Department of Justice, sits down with Kevin Downing and Kevin O'Connor, and says, I've got all this information about terrorist financing and Swiss banks and accounts and Abdullah Aziz, a major Al-Qaeda financier. I want to give it, but I can't give it without a subpoena. You have to subpoena me. And the Department of Justice said to him, you're not a whistleblower, you're a tipster. And they refused to give him a subpoena. They refused to hear any of his information. They refused to take any of the papers that he had, which were incredibly significant. 19,000 bank accounts, lots of which are belonging to bad guys in the Middle East right now that have been used over the last 5, 6, 7 years to kill Americans and our allies. So the Department of Justice don't want any of that. They don't want to talk to him. They won't give him a subpoena. So he runs right over across the street to the IRS. And the IRS, again, this is all information that Brad has told me and sat down with me over 6 months, and we've diagrammed it and written down it exhaustively. He goes over to the IRS. The IRS refused to give him a subpoena. So that's significant. So he next goes over to the United States Senate into Carl Levin's office, the Senate Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations. And they give him a subpoena. He goes in, he testifies behind closed doors on all of the material that he has, and next thing he knows, he returns to Switzerland or something, and he tells a very significant story, and that is he had a friend in when he excuse me, when he was over giving a lot of this material, he was, I think, flying back and forth. He had a friend who was a London banker who had a Middle Eastern name, who was on his way to Mexico and called Brad up and said, "Hey, I'm going to Mexico. Where are you?" "I'm in the United States." He said, "Great, I'll pick you up." Now, this is a rich, very wealthy banker. He has his own private plane. He flies down into the United States, picks Brad up. They go to Mexico, have a good time, and flies back. Well, that banker in London had been written a letter, and that letter, Brad showed me a copy, and I have a copy of it. The letter had said, "Brad Birkenfeld is releasing information." That letter had been written to UBS. This letter had been written to UBS saying Brad Birkenfeld is giving information to the American authorities. And it was signed his friend's name. UBS had called Brad's friend and said, "Why did you send us this letter?" And his friend had said, "I never sent you any sort of a letter." And UBS had faxed him a copy of this letter, and it said, July 2007, to Union Bank of Switzerland from Mohammed, whatever his name was, "Brad Birkenfeld is giving information to the American authorities. You should be advised." And Brad's friend said, "I never sent this letter." And he called Brad up and said, "What is this all about? I just got a letter that was forged." And Brad said, I can't go into it, but send me a copy of the letter." He sent Brad a copy of the letter. Brad went in with his lawyer and said to the Department of Justice, "What is this?" And the Department of Justice, Kevin Downing, Kevin O'Connor, "Well, we don't know. We'll investigate it." They never did. It disappeared. What's significant about that is, the only way that that could have transpired is if Brad Birkenfeld had walked into the Department of Justice, gave his cell phone and his email and all that information, saying, "Here's what I've got, contact me." They then in turn took that, and I've written this up in my analysis, which was presented September 25th, 2012, to military commanders in the Congress. That material was then given to CIA, NSA, and they tracked Brad, tracked his friend, flying in from Europe, picking him up and going to Mexico. They tracked that information and used that information to cobble a false, fraudulent letter and sent that to Union Bank of Switzerland, hoping that Brad, when he returned, would be killed, thrown in jail, something. And that struck me as very profound. So you do have the intelligence agencies and the Department of Justice working in tandem just on Brad's situation alone, where they're tracking him and they cobble this false letter together. Well, in any case, that's significant. But the Department of Justice approached Brad and said, "We're going to indict you for conspiracy because you didn't tell us everything pertaining to your such as Alenikov." And Brad had said, "Excuse me, I did tell you this. I told him it in the Senate testimony. Go back and you'll see it. In fact, you emailed me prior. My attorneys advised you that I did release that information." And they said, "Oh, yes, well, we'll check into it." And they came back later and said, "No, well, we're going to indict you for conspiracy based on the Alenikov issue." And Brad said, "Well, get my transcript from the Senate testimony and you'll see I revealed that." And they told him, "No, we cannot because they are sealed. And because they're sealed, you can't use them as defense." And Brad had no way to defend himself. It was his word against their sealed transcripts.
Incredible.
Now, that's significant, too, because they did the same thing to Joe Nocio. Joe Nocio was the CEO of Quest Communications, who had been involved with NSA.
Have played a huge hand in creating them. Spending billions of dollars issues, training and arming rebels across
just prior
the region.
To 9/11,
they completely dismantled the government in Iraq and then left the country in complete shambles with an incredibly weak puppet regime in place. And of course, the U.S. continues to mess around in the area, angering people who are sick of being pawns in American war games. So, it's just a fact that the U.S. was a big creator of ISIS. The only question is, why? Well, we just created something else ISIS-related that answers to that. The government just formed an entire new command to combat ISIS. It's called the Combined Joint Task Force-Operation Inherent Resolve, and it'll be led by Army Lieutenant General James Terry. Its purpose is to oversee coalition and U.S. operations based overseas. Previously, U.S. Central Command had been in charge, and the formation of the new task force has experts scratching their heads because they just can't see why yet another task force was created. Officials of the new command refused to say where the new operation will be headquartered. An official statement was released, which indicated that the new command held a conference of coalition partners somewhere in Southeast Asia earlier this month. And the statement said that leaders from all over the world shared ideas and engaged in dialogue about their roles at the conference. And yeah, that's about it. Those were all the details in the release about the new command. Their new leader was supposed to provide a briefing to the media about the new command, but that got postponed. So there aren't any details about this new mission to fight ISIS, really. Except for this one fun thing. They have a logo. They won't tell us anything about it. Not where it is, not what exactly they'll be doing differently than Central Command, just that it exists, and it has a logo with a stupid olive branch on it, as if it's all about peace. So back to that question about why our government keeps creating terrorists. It is most definitely not about peace. It is most definitely just about money. Because you can be sure the new combined joint task force operation is going to be a big moneymaker for the same people who always profit from our military-industrial complex. We made ISIS so that those guys can keep making money. And anyone who believes otherwise will keep being made a fool. Just watch how much money we dump into this new command for all the proof you'll need. Tonight, let's talk about that.
All three major parties support war in Iraq. Now even the Liberal Democrats meeting in Glasgow today want bombing. But what about Britain's role in sponsoring ISIS? With me is former MI5 agent Annie Machon. Annie, welcome back to Going Underground. So is this a continuation of the 2003 war, first of all?
I think it's certainly an expected outcome. Even senior spies were advising Tony Blair back in 2003, particularly the head of MI5, Dame Eliza Mannion-Buller. She was saying, if we do this, we are going to be causing more problems in the future and creating new generations of terrorists. And even she has gone on the record since as well and said, we can't defeat terrorism by war. What we have to do is negotiate, as we did with the provisional IRA. So yes, Britain has a diabolical responsibility for what is now happening to the terrorized peoples in Syria and in Iraq.
But yet, by going in, we're increasing the threat.
Well, the threat to British national security particularly as well, which, of course, was supposedly her mandate. So it was very cavalier for the then Prime Minister, Tony Blair, to just dismiss the thought-out advice of the top spy in the UK dedicated to protecting our national security in Britain.
And she repeated that evidence of the Chilcot Inquiry, which
we still don't know
about. But she, in fairness, since everyone's saying how wonderful she is, she didn't really mention about how the intelligence services may have been funding those very groups. So we know, obviously, about how we helped fund and train the Mujahideen in Afghanistan. Who are we training now that we're now trying to kill?
Well, very good question. I mean, the intelligence agencies in the UK have a long and ignoble history of funding people they think will be helpful to fight other perceived threats in danger zones around the world. And then, of course, that goes wrong, and these groups now, we're very well funded, come back and bite them. We saw that in Libya in the 1990s. We've seen that in Iraq and in Syria as well over the last few years. So this is perfectly standard, but you think they would learn from their mistakes in the past. They would see that, well, it didn't happen so well there. Now we've got an Al-Qaeda, type affiliates running rampant across Libya. Why on earth? Did they advise David Cameron to try and intercede in Syria last year to topple Assad and fund these very groups, which, of course, has now led to al-Nusra and other groups mutating into ISIS? And that's precisely what we're seeing.
But you're suggesting incompetence. Even seasoned observers of incompetence by the Foreign Office and its agencies, even they are saying, and they're not people who like conspiracy, are saying, how could any government be this incompetent when it comes to, as we say now, tornadoes bombing people that British taxpayers themselves may have been funding as recently as last year?
Well, you say incompetent, I would say thick. But, of course, these are predictable outcomes. So they must have had that advice. They must have been aware of the risks they were taking. And there must be some other deeper understanding, potential benefit, either to perhaps certain segments of industry, the arms industry, the oil industry, whatever.
But you worked in the intelligence services. There's no way someone from BAE Systems, I think, that make the GR4 Tornado would come into the office there in MI6, for instance, I suppose it would be, saying, come on then, last year I was telling you to do this, now I'm telling you to buy more of this to bomb that.
Well, we know very well that big corporations do use strong lobbying against the politicians, and the politicians very often go along with it. In fact, there was only a report today or yesterday, I think, Sir Jeremy Hayward, the top civil servant in the country, who's now known as Sir Cover-Up, I think, because he's the one who refused to disseminate the private communications between Blair and Bush in the Chilcot inquiry, which is why it's been held up. So Sir Cover-Up has now been outed as having all these lovely dinners and all expenses paid trips to the opera and all the rest of it with precisely these sort of companies. So that is where the influence is done. It's not sitting down in an office and having a proper meeting. It's, you know, having a few drinks at the opera or going out for fine wines and a big lunch or something. And it does go on. It's naive to think that it wouldn't. And it's naive to think that parties which are dependent on donations from these big corporations will turn deaf ears to the interests of those big corporations.
But the intelligence agencies themselves more immune to it than the opera-going politicians?
Well, there tend to be revolving doors, particularly between MI6 and certain of these big companies when these people retire at 55. And they're, you know, often good chums and they know each other, same background and things like that. So there's very strong interconnection there. So even, for example, if MI5 were advising against this misadventure in Syria that has metastasized into ISIS, even if they were doing that, there is a good chance that their rivals and often mortal enemies, MI6, would be advising the very opposite and putting the sort of corporate screws on the government. Go ahead and do this for their chums. Well, I'm not saying that's the case, but that's how it can work. And
well, either way, MI5, if Dame Eliza was accurate then, probably no less accurate now, they'll be left to pick up the pieces. Do you think the fact that we have intelligence in the groups that we're trying to then afterwards attack gives us any advantage when it comes to the home attacks that we can now expect because of the war in Iraq?
I would hope that by cultivating some of these contacts and perhaps being able to turn them, we can go back to a greater reliance on human intelligence, on human, because that's where you get the precise information about planned terrorist plots and things like that. And it's also how you can gather evidence and then hopefully arrest people and put them on trial.
So in a sense, by creating our own enemies, we're better at being able to tackle them.
I think it's a slightly disingenuous interpretation, but no, of course, they will be doing this. And Britain historically was always much better at humans. It was always the Americans that over-relied on technological superiority and, you know, electronic surveillance and things. Unfortunately, what we have seen over the last decade, since 9/11 and the war on terror began, is the British being pulled more and more into the orbit of the American intelligence community, and they've lost that sort of human edge, and they've gone increasingly, as we've seen from the Edward Snowden disclosures, down the path of big dragnet surveillance.
And there's a new scandal. Let's see, MiddleEastEye.net news. Jeremy Corbyn demands official investigation, Israeli embassy scandal. While the little thing goes around, maybe I'll read this. Shalmas, I don't know how to pronounce his last name, but boy, what a slow computer.
Shut up!
And they will say, yes, but we have to have this big surveillance because then we can find these individual terrorists. They have human sources that they can turn within these groups and get detailed, pinpointed information back on what is being planned. Much more effective than dragnet surveillance and looking for that fabled needle in the haystack.
So Jeremy Hayward, incidentally, of course, related to the Snowden stuff, because it was him who walked into the Guardian, tried to smash up the computers.
Well, perhaps we should call this a smash up then, rather than
cover
up.
He's welcome to be on this program anytime. Well, but then if we were so good at human intelligence. Even journalists were saying when Cameron wanted us to bomb Assad's troops for the rebels, even journalists were saying that these rebels were obviously allied to forces that back the Saudi Wahhabi cause. Mm-hmm. Why did MI6 not report back immediately to the William Hague or Hammond and say, look, this is a mess?
Obviously, they're reading the wrong newspapers. No, it was generally accepted, of course. You know, my enemy's enemy is always going to be my enemy. You know, it's not necessarily going to be an effective friend. So there must be some deeper reason why the spies have not put the brakes on this funding.
And you're suggesting it could be the lobbying? Because as you said, if it's in the public domain that Britain is supporting people that would do Britain harm, MI6 definitely knew that we were doing that.
Well, I don't know for sure in this case, but I know for sure in older cases, particularly if we look at what happened in Libya, where Sir Mark Allen, who was the head of the counterterrorism section in MI6, then went on to work for BP, was one of the key go-betweens between Blair and Gaddafi for the deal in the desert and the handing over of the torture victim, Abdel Hakim Balhaj, and all the rest of it. So they were willing to hand over people for torture. They were willing to make dodgy deals in the desert, all in order to get the oil deals for BP and other corporate interests. So we know that. It's all on the public record.
Although the then head of BP came on Going Underground recently and said, actually, it's that was all coincidence. So how close do you think our ties are to Turkish intelligence then? Because Britain is now in effect supporting the PKK by the Tornado's bombing, which is a proscribed terror group here in Britain. But aside from that, do you think the intelligence sharing with the French, with the Americans, how do you think that's going? Because we are at war now.
Well, we're not officially at war, are we?
Well, they voted for war.
They're sealed transcripts.
Incredible.
Now, that's significant, too, because they did the same thing to Joe
Nocio. It's not against
the Islamic State, which they seem to recognize. I don't know.
Quest Communications,
what do you think?
Who had been involved with...
recognition, they're legitimizing it, which is crazy. So it's all this sort of circular thinking that makes a mess of the situation time and time and time again. They will have to be working more closely with Turkey and its intelligence agencies. I'm not sure historically if they did greatly. But one of the problems we're seeing post-Snowden, of course, is this sort of breakdown of trust about how much information you do share between different countries' intelligence agencies. And I think...
NSA phone issues just prior to 9/11. A lot of this is open source material, so you can Google and look up Joe Nocio and a lot of the story behind that. And he had been approached by the NSA to release a lot of the information on clients for Quest Communications, and he refused to do that. And Quest Communications subsequently dried up his contracts. He sold stock. Next thing you know, they come at him for insider trading. And he said, all this material is in the transcripts about NSA, you know, coming to me, asking me to do this, and I wouldn't do it. And they said, no, those transcripts are sealed.
Incredible.
And they threw charges at him, and he had to cop a plea because they said, we'll face 20 years or give you five. And a man who's married with children, they make a pretty quick decision, go for the five. But that's an illustrated version of their tactic of sealing material, sealing information, and then forcing the person into a plea bargain. They did that to Brad. They did it to Joe Nocio. Joe Nocio's son was in Georgetown and had been stabbed in the arm by two men in suits who said, say hi to your dad for us. So there are some real dark elements and dark characters involved here, and I know your audience is sufficiently intellectually equipped to appreciate that and probably have far more interesting research levels of that than I do. But all of this came to me through unclassified sources and directly from word of mouth who the people who it happened to. And when you sit down with someone and look them eye to eye for months on end and they tell you this story exhaustively from every angle, you know it's true.
Congressman, thanks a lot for coming on.
Thank you very much, Secretary.
So I was just really struck by that. You were one of the very first people he met with. Now, you issued a press release, and I'm sure some of you're a liberal Democrat, I think it's fair to say. Some of your constituents must have been confused, and you issued this statement. You said, I felt it was important to take the opportunity to meet with the president-elect now before the drumbeats of war that neocons have been beating drag us into an escalation of the war to overthrow the Syrian government.
That's right.
What did you mean by that, I guess, beyond what you said? And do you believe that the president-elect agrees with your views on this?
I have long been outspoken about the devastating problems with our U.S. policy, generally on interventionist wars, and very specifically on the need to end our counterproductive regime change war to overthrow the Syrian government. Hundreds of thousands of people have lost their lives, millions of refugees, and the counterproductive result of this has been that these groups like ISIS and Al-Qaeda and other terrorist groups who we proclaim to be our enemy have ended up growing stronger. So understanding that we have a new commander-in-chief coming in, president-elect coming into office very soon, I took the opportunity to be able to get across this message to him. As a veteran, knowing and seeing firsthand the cost of war, I felt it was critical to do my part to try to help influence this new administration and extend this call to action to them to end this counterproductive war that has caused so much devastation.
So what was his response?
It was a very good conversation. He had some very good questions, and he was very receptive to the message that I was bringing. And frankly, this is an area that is not partisan. This is an issue that both Democrats and Republicans should get behind to stop arming terrorists, to stop this action that has not only caused devastation, but again, it has resulted both directly and indirectly strengthening those whom we are supposed to be trying to defeat.
Right. Well, actually, there's bipartisan disagreement with you, as you well know. So your bill is called Stop Arming Terrorists. You've introduced it. And your idea, as I understand it, is, look, the average American, you, me, not allowed to send weapons or aid terror groups.
We would be thrown in jail.
But the U.S. government, as a matter of policy, arms and aids these groups for a bunch of different reasons. But that's happening.
Well, and this is the problem, Tucker, is that there's a double standard here. That for years now, our government, working with countries like Saudi Arabia, Turkey and Qatar, have been, through the CIA, quietly been arming and supporting these groups that are directly working with groups like Al-Qaeda and ISIS, all in this effort to overthrow the Syrian government. They've been funneling support through countries like Saudi Arabia and others, who are also, again, directly supporting these groups. This is madness that this has been allowed to occur for so long, and madness that we have allowed the devastating consequences to occur as a result without checking it. And that's exactly what my bill does. The Stop Arming Terrorist Act very simply prohibits using American taxpayer dollars through any agency overt or covert, whether it be the CIA, the DOD, or any other agency, from directly or indirectly providing weapons, money, intelligence, or other types of support to these groups that are allied with and working with groups like Al-Qaeda, as this is happening right now today in Syria.
Well, you obviously haven't been listening to some famous members of the Senate who've described those groups as freedom fighters, and you just don't understand how great they are.